And thank you for those. I appreciate that. And good thoughts to consider as we close out our day today. What a joy to bring things to our God and have those loads and burdens lifted off of us as we come to Him and see Him meet those needs and supply in ways that we oftentimes would never dream possible, and yet He does. So, good hymns to consider. Let's turn to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7. I didn't go back and look to see when it was that we were last in the book of Acts. I was kind of a little more fearful that it was longer than I was thinking that we were here, but it does seem like a long time ago. We had finished chapter 6 and had Stephen being taken away. And noting in verse 15, it says, "And all that sat in the council looked steadfastly on him, saw his face as it had been the face of an angel." And so he's there with the Sanhedrin. And chapter 7 is Stephen's defense. And Stephen is going to look at Israel's history in order to give his defense for why he was preaching Christ. It kind of bring us back a little bit to remind ourselves, why are we looking at Stephen? Stephen had gone to the synagogue back up in chapter 6, verse 9. Stephen had gone into a synagogue of the Libertines, the Cyrenians, the Alexandrians, of them of Cilicia and of Asia, and he preached Christ. He spoke in the synagogue. And as we mentioned then, in all likelihood, Paul may have been there, or Saul of Tarsus, because Tarsus is in the province of Cilicia. So this could have been a synagogue that Saul would have frequented while he was in Jerusalem in his unsaved days. Again, because of it having people from where he grew up. It's not definitive. I'm not, being dogmatic, yes. Saul was there. We know he's going to be in the council at the end of the chapter because he's going to go with the men that take Stephen out to stone him because he's going to hold their coats. But it kind of begs the question, how did he get into the special council? Because he wasn't on the Sanhedrin. He is going to be at their disposal, as we know, coming up in chapter 8. But my speculation then is going back that he was part of the group there in the synagogue when Stephen preaches, when he speaks of Christ, and they don't like it, and they move him out of there, take him to the council to have this trial against him, in essence, for heresy. Because again, we know that the Sanhedrin does not want Christ preached. We've already seen that in the previous chapters, as they got James and Peter, as they got all of them in chapters 4 and chapters 5, told them, don't preach in this name, don't do this, and they still do. And here we have now not the leaders, the apostles, the pastors, but we have a deacon. And so we've seen a kind of a change, if you will, in how to approach Christians in Jerusalem. It didn't work to tell the leaders, stop. So now they've captured one of theirs, a deacon, and then Saul's going to get in it, and we won't preach chapter 8, but we see a change in chapter 8 then. But, Satan will do what he can to stop the work of Christ. If he cannot take out the leadership, then what's the next thing he can go after? The lay people. And we kind of see that progression here in the book. The leaders first, that wasn't successful. Let's deal with the deacon. Okay, that's not really successful, so let's go after the lay people by sending Saul of Tarsus with his threatenings and hailing people and bringing them in, and they're scattered. But again, I'm not going to preach chapter 8 as much as I want to get there, but that's coming up. But we're focusing here on Stephen, and we come to Stephen's council question, how are these things so? Verse 1 of chapter 7, it says, "Then said the high priest, are these things so?" And he answers them, his discourse, if you will, or his message. What an opportunity. Are these things so? Of what you've been preaching, what is this? What are you doing? And Stephen is given an open door. And he said, "Men, brethren, and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Charan," or Haran, as we know. The spelling difference comes from the fact that we're going from Hebrew to Greek to English. It's Haran in the Old Testament because we're going from Hebrew to English. And our translators in on the New Testament side were kind of a language removed between the Old Testament and the New Testament spelling because we've gone through the Greek language. Some newer translations may put Haran there instead of Charan. So just to give you an idea, why is it spelled that way instead of something else? It's because it's gone through a couple languages before it got to ours. And so it changes a little bit. But before he dwelt in Haran is where we're talking about. So we're going to have Stephen's discourse, and I'd like to try to cover all of it, but we'll see. I come to it kind of in three different avenues. Instead of taking it verse by verse in our Bible here, there's kind of different layers, if you want to call it layers, of what he's addressing as he talks about their history. And so we see, first of all, the patriarchs, verses 2 through 8. The Egyptian sojourn of Joseph in 9 through 16. The deliverance under Moses in verses 17 through 43. And the building of the temple, or the tabernacle, 44 through 46. The construction of the temple in verses 47 through 55. But then I kind of back up and try this in another tact, if you will. The blessings of God are not limited to the land of Israel and the temple area. And so we look at some of the blessings, if you will, by then coming back through this passage again and noting those. And then kind of lastly, Israel in its past always evidenced a pattern of opposition to God's plans and men. And again, we look at that as we go through this passage. We see those blessings, and yet we see the Israelites not wanting to enjoy those blessings. So that's kind of the layout there. And lastly, verses 51 through 53 is Stephen's charge to the council as he goes back and looks at their history and gives them, you know, a very detailed history lesson, which... Okay, what... Oh, okay, that was interesting. It took me back to chapter 1. Let me get back up to my chapter 7 notes. So he gives them their history, which they would know. Because again, we're talking to the Sanhedrin, the men who have been rabbis for all their lives, that would know the scriptures forwards and backwards. They've been studying it, they've been reading it for many of them for decades, because these are older men of Israel at that time. And so it would come as no surprise, but and yet that history lesson is invaluable. I mean, one, that's why we have the Old Testament still. Paul will tell the Corinthians, in chapter 10, these are for our examples. And he gives a little history lesson there. This is what the Israelites did. And it didn't turn out so well. So in essence, learn from history. It didn't go well with them when they went against God. So what should that tell us about us and our lives with God? Do we want to go against God? No, we shouldn't. Again, we have ample history of showing us this is what happens when you go against God as one of His. It doesn't end pretty. He takes us home. And yet, what happens? We often go down those same paths because we have that same human nature. But we need to look at those and realize these things and again, inculcate them into our lives. But as we look at this, as we know, if there's progress and change in God's program, we have the patriarchs, verses 2 through 8, as God calls Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees from Mesopotamia. That just means the land between the rivers. And if you look in your Bible maps in the back, some of the older maps that have the Old Testament, the land between the rivers, meaning between the Tigris and the Euphrates, there in what is modern-day Iraq today, part of the Fertile Crescent, that crescent stretching from where the Tigris and Euphrates enter the Persian Gulf, they sweep around to the north, and then come down against the Mediterranean Sea. And that was typically the travel track. You went kind of northwest before you started heading southeast. You didn't go straight west. That took you across desert, the top of the Arabian Desert, the Syrian Desert, and they typically did not travel that way because it's desert. And they stuck close to where the water sources are in their travels. So that's where he's referring to. And verse 3, and he says, and he said unto him, get thee out of thy kindred and from thy kindred, and come unto the land which I shall show thee. Then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Charran. And from thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land wherein ye now dwell. Again, now they would know this, but they note that this is what happened. We know the story. God called Abraham. And he called him to leave his country. And he left and went about halfway. Haran is at the north of that Fertile Crescent arc. And stopped there because his father had gone with him. Don't know why. As you read Genesis chapter 12 and the end of chapter 11 to get the genealogy and then following forward, it notes there that Terah went with Abraham, Abram. They went together along with Lot to Haran, but it doesn't tell us the why Terah went. But he does. And Terah dies in Haran, and so Abraham continues then the journey, leaving there and heading to that land that he does not know where, because God didn't give him the map ahead of time. God's leading him. And taking him to what we know as the promised land, the land that God promised to them. And so they continue after that death to the land of promise. We continue on. And verse 5, and he gave him none inheritance in it, no, not so much as to set his foot on, yet he promised that he would give it to him for a possession and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. And God spake on this wise, that his seed would sojourn in a strange land, and that they should bring them into bondage and entreat them evil 400 years. And so he's touching on these things and noting, when he brought Abraham there, did he give him the land to possess? And I use that word specifically, to possess. No. I mean, did Abraham go to the promised land? Yes, he did go to the promised land. He sojourned there. As you follow, and again, in the book of Genesis, as you read through his time there, he's moving about. He stops in Shechem. He stops in Beersheba. He's in Hebron. He's in Mamre. He moves over closer to the coast with Abimelech and the Philistines. So you see him, as the herdsman that he is, he's moving about because his herds need to move. If you've seen pictures of southern Israel, even to this day, it's not the fertile part of Israel. The Negev, as it is called, the southern part of Israel, is very desert-like still to this day. great for doing certain things, but you've got to move about for the water and for what you need for your cattle that you may have. So they move. He's moving about for that reason. And so, but it's not his land. He doesn't have a title deed to it. The only thing he will have a title deed to is when he buys a burial plot at Machpelah to bury his wife. That'll be the only title deed that he would have in his possession of the promised land, because he purchased it from the locals that were there so he could bury Sarah. And so apart from that, it's not his, but he is living in it. And again, he kind of alludes here, his offspring are going to live there. Isaac is going to be born. He's going to live there, but he doesn't have the title deed to the land either. Isaac's going to have Jacob and Esau. Does Jacob have title deed to this land? No. He wanders about as well. Again, as these cattlemen, as we might use the modern term of a Bedouin, who travels about to find, again, pasture land for their animals. And so they are traveling about. It's not their land yet. It's land promised to them. And as Stephen notes here, God told them back in Genesis chapter 15, as God speaks to Abraham, that your offspring are going to dwell in the land of Egypt. They're going to land there for 400 years. And what does he tell us at the end of Genesis 15, verses 12 through 16, as I believe we come to verse 16, he notes something as to why he's going to move the children of Israel out of the promised land, take them to Egypt for 400 years for a reason. He's dealing with the people in the land. And he notes the iniquity of the Amorites is not full. You can't have the land until I am done dealing with the Amorites. God's merciful. God's gracious. And as we look at our Old Testaments, as we read of the Jewish nation, are they God's chosen people? Yes. Are they a perfect people? No. And when we look at the Old Testament, as we read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Joshua, and we see God bringing them back into that land, God's been dealing with the other people as well. And as he notes to Abraham 400 years before, their iniquity is not yet to the point where I am finished dealing with them as far as trying to reach them to myself. But that time will come. And when it comes, that's when you can occupy this land, because I will be dealing with them in judgment. And we see that happen. In essence, part of the action that Israel is doing as a nation by coming into the land, do they get it with no problems? No, they don't. Sometimes they have to fight. They are God's form of judgment against those that are there, because their iniquity was not full yet. They hadn't reached that point of no return. The God saying, enough, enough. Okay, you've not accepted my grace. You've not accepted my mercy. Then you will get my judgment. If you're not going to turn to me, there's going to come a point of time that you're beyond the point of no return, and my hand of judgment comes upon you. And so we see those things happening. And so Israel is out of the way. They become a great nation down there in Egypt. Again, we know the story. God's going to judge the land of Egypt as well. Let's continue our reading. And he says, in the nation, verse 7, to whom they shall be in bondage, will I judge, said God, and after that they shall come forth and serve me in this place. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham begat Isaac and circumcised him the eighth day. And Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat the 12 patriarchs, down to verse 8. And so we see the patriarchs' time. Those are the three that we know as the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. The 12 patriarchs, as they're called, we think of the 12 tribes based on those 12 sons. So we move on then to Egypt's sojourn with Joseph, because he becomes the focal point. In verse 9 it says, "And the patriarchs, moved with envy, sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him." And notice Luke, as he gives this account, as Stephen is speaking, Stephen is using words that we find back in Genesis with Joseph. And we find those words, "but God was with him." Do we find those words at high points in Joseph's life? If you're familiar with the account, we don't. We find them actually at the opposite, at the low points. But God was with him. When? When Potiphar had him cast into prison. But God was with him. And was God with him on the high points? Yes, he was. But it's interesting how we have to be reminded of that on the low points, don't we? We're on the high points. Are we questioning whether or not God is with us? Typically not. If we're enjoying God's blessings, we know they're God's blessings. But when we have the hardships, when we have the trials, is that one of the first things that comes to our mind? Well, God's with me. It's usually not. We usually have to be reminded of it somewhere along the road. You know, God is still with you. He told you he would never leave you nor forsake you. So yes, he is here with you in this low time, in this hardship, whatever the case may be. He is still with you. And we have to be reminded of that. And I think God puts it there for that, for our understanding. He is with you. We see it in the life of Joseph. Stephen brings that up here. God was with him. When we look at the overall plan, as we will see at the end of Genesis, Joseph will say what? About the whole being sold into slavery and all of that happening. "You, my brothers, meant it for evil, but," love that three-letter word, "but God meant it for good." Because by their selling him into slavery, he gets into Egypt. And by the time the famines come, and he's able to save his brothers and father, is he a lowly steward in the house of Potiphar? No. He's second in command of all of Egypt. Because through some circumstances beyond his control, Potiphar has him cast into prison. He interprets some dreams. One's a good dream that comes true, and the other one is a kind of a bad dream that comes true too, but the guy loses his head over it. The one guy that has survived and comes back forgets about telling the Pharaoh about Joseph, because he told him, you know, "Please remember me when you get up there. I'm here on, you know, trumped up charges." And he forgets. Until Pharaoh has some dreams that he's troubled by. And his servant, I'm sure, maybe he, you know, popped his head. "Oh, yes! Joe, I know someone that can help you with this. We were in prison together." And up comes Joseph. And as you look at that passage, I think the Pharaoh is a child at this time. Because you will find later, Joseph, when talking to his brothers, will say, "I am like a father to Pharaoh." So as you know, the turning over of pharaohs in Egypt, If dad dies, if the kids, if the Pharaoh, the next Pharaoh is a boy, he's the king, just like we see in the Israelites as well. We have some young kings of Israel. But so I think he is a young individual who likes what he hears from Joseph and says, fine, make it happen. Sounds like you got the means to see that we can survive these 7 years of famine that are coming up. So I'm putting you in charge of this. You make sure that our nation survives. And because of that, that famine that spreads on into Israel affects his family. And they are able to come to Egypt and survive. So we see that God is with him. He's going to deliver them, verse 10, and delivered him out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he made him governor over Egypt and all his house. Now there came a dearth over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers found no sustenance. But when Jacob heard that there was corn in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. And at the second time, Joseph was made known to his brethren, and Joseph's kindred was made known unto Pharaoh. Then sent Joseph and called his father Jacob to him and all his kindred, 75 souls. So Jacob went down into Egypt and died, he and our fathers. And so we make it through verse 16. And were carried over unto Sychem and laid in the sepulcher that Abraham bought for a sum of money of the sons of Emor, the father of Sychem. And so we have that sojourning in Egypt, looking at the focus of Joseph and what happened. Just briefly, Luke here notes 75 souls, 75. 75. If you know the Old Testament passages, is that the number we find back in Genesis and Exodus? It's not. We find the number 70. Which one is correct? They both are. So, well, how can that be? The speculate, and it can only be on speculation, as one commentator notes. First of all, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. That's the book, the Bible, that Luke quotes from when he writes his account. He doesn't use the Hebrew. He uses the Septuagint. Again, the Greek translation of the Old Testament Hebrew. And if you look in the Septuagint, back in those same passages that the Hebrew says 70, says 75. So he's quoting from that version, not the Hebrew. Why the difference? As again, one commentator notes, it could be alluding to Joseph's grandchildren who would have been in Egypt already. We don't know, because we don't have the translators of the Septuagint to talk to and ask them, why did you put 75 here when the Hebrew has 70? So it is one of those that we're left to wonder why the difference. We don't know for sure. But as we look at some genealogies, it could be true that by that time that Joseph would have had some grandchildren that could have been figured into this mix. And that's why they pulled the 75. Again, we don't know because those translators didn't leave any notes saying this is why we use 75 instead of 70. Does that mean that our Bible is not trustworthy? No. It doesn't. It just shows that there's two numbers there that we cannot bring together for some reason that God has chosen not to fully let us see why. But to me, it doesn't shake the trustworthiness of our scriptures. It just notes changes take place as we move through translations. And we see those things. We see that Abraham and Jacob, As they take Jacob's body back when he dies, they go up to Machpelah, to the cave of Machpelah, and in Hebron, and bury him there. Joseph is buried in Shechem when they bring his bones back with the Israelites. And so we see that taking place. As one notes here, it talks about the Shechem and Joseph and the like. Why is he noting Shechem when he's talking about Jacob? F.F. Bruce argues, and I'm quoting, F.F. Bruce argues that Stephen telescoped the two accounts, Jacob's burial, Joseph's burial, the two accounts together in a long sermon that is not an unusual practice. The Sanhedrin certainly knew the Old Testament record well enough to follow exactly what Stephen was arguing. Others have suggested that since Abraham built an altar in Shechem, that he had purchased the land for the altar and Jacob had repurchased it in his day. So there's no discrepancy in who's buried where and who's owning what. Just noting those things that are there. Deliverance under Moses, verses 17 through 43, the kind of the crux of the passage, if you will, says, but when the time of the promise drew nigh, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose, which knew not Joseph. The same dealt subtly with our kindred, and evil entreated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children, to the end they might not live. In which time Moses was born, and was exceeding fair, and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. We'll pause there for a moment. We're rehearsing history that I trust we know and are familiar with. God's promise to Abraham is going to become a reality. And we see that happening as they're there in Egypt. There arises a Pharaoh that knows not Joseph. A dynasty change has probably taken place as we look at the history of Egypt. Many will put Joseph being there during what is called the Hyksos dynasty. These were not Egyptians ruling Egypt. They were outsiders like Joseph was. But eventually that dynasty ends and a new one starts in and the Egyptians are ruling themselves again. And many believe that that's where that change takes place. The Hyksos would have been a little more favorable about having Joseph in command, second to Pharaoh, as opposed to an Egyptian having this Hebrew second in command. But once that dynasty has moved out and the Egyptians are taking place, are they going to be favorable to an outsider and their people? No, they're not. And so that's where some dynasty, I think, changes are taking place that cause these issues. The Egyptians don't like the Israelites. We know that from reading in the book of Exodus. They're fearful because the Jews have been multiplying and they've become their servants. What if we have another outside invasion? Our servants may rise up in revolt against us. And so we see the problems going on. They need to do some birth control. And that's not too favorable. And Moses is brought into that period when this takes place. And we know the story. God's at work. They place him in that little ark made of bulrushes and puts him on the Nile River. Pharaoh's daughter just happens to come at that right time. Yes, she just happens to come at that right time. Why? Because God's orchestrating things. And he's going to be brought up in Pharaoh's household and become mighty in words and deeds, which is an interesting statement that Stephen puts here. What does Moses say at the burning bush? years later, trying to keep our timeline. But we're told here, in those first 40 years, Moses is brought up in Pharaoh's household. He's mighty in words and deeds. We know the events that take place, which Stephen's going to touch on in a minute. And he heads to the backside of the desert for another 40 years. And as he's 80 years old, he comes across this burning bush. What does he tell God when God says, I want you to go to Egypt and lead my people out? I'm not qualified. I cannot speak. We see some excuses. I mean, we already know that story. Excuses are being made. And Stephen notes that he was mighty in words and in deeds. He could speak, and we see that happening. It's one of those incidences in the scriptures that I find rather humorous. As God is talking with Moses about all of this, he finally says, okay, I'm going to send you your brother. And your brother will be your mouthpiece. You will be like God to him so that he speaks. And as we watch the progression through the plagues and all, what do we see transpire? It starts off with his brother being the spokesman, but what happens by the time we get to the end of the plagues? It's Moses. He's the one standing up and speaking and proclaiming. He took God at his word and followed God in his word. And we see him becoming the leader that God had told him he could be. But we see some of this going on as we continue in our passage here. Because again, Stephen, I think by inspiration, helps add some things to that Old Testament passages here. Because we note in verse 23, it says, and when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. Now, we know that part. Again, if we read Exodus, we know that. But notice the next verse. It's not noted back in Exodus. We just know that, yes, he came up, he saw an Egyptian and a Hebrew having problems. He tries to rectify the situation. He ends up killing the Egyptian, buries him in the sand, thinking everything's okay, nobody knows. But then he sees two Israelites the next day arguing, and one of them says, as he tries to break them up, what, you're going to kill me too? Like you did the Egyptian? Oh, okay, that wasn't done in secret. I need to leave. And it doesn't note what we're about to read in verse 25. It says, for he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand, Moses' hand, would deliver them. But they understood not. So now we have a little more wrinkle with what was going back in Exodus. Yes, Moses sees the injustice, but he's also wanting to be Moses the deliverer. I'm here, guys. I want to lead you out. But the timing is off. Does God want Israel to leave right then when Moses is 40 years old? Nope. Does Moses understand Abraham's prophecy from Genesis? I think so. How long are the Israelites going to be in Egypt? 400 years. Obviously, they're nearing that time. And Moses kind of takes it upon himself. I'm trained in the ways of Egypt. I know something. Let's go. Hey, see, I'm with you guys. You had this Egyptian and this Hebrew, you know, arguing. I sided with the Hebrews, not the Egyptian. And it doesn't work out. They understood not. And the next day, verse 26, he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again, saying, sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one to another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, who made thee a ruler and judge over us. Wilt thou kill me as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday? Then Moses fled at this saying, and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begat two sons. And so we see God using Stephen's discourse to add a little more about what took place back then. Moses sought to be the deliverer, but in his own strength, in his own way, and God said, no, this is not the time. So do we understand then a little more about why Moses is then hesitant 40 years later? When God comes to him in the burning bush and says, I want you to lead my people Israel out of Egypt. Could we not see some hesitancy here? You know, I tried that once and it didn't work out so well. You want me to go back and do this again? Now again, Moses doesn't use that argument, but we can see that taking place, if you will. Why he's hesitant. Why he's trying to bargain with God, and it's not working out. So Moses flees to the backside of the wilderness, has two sons, as we'll continue reading. Verse 30, and when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai, an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush. When Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight, and as he drew near to behold it, the voice of the Lord came unto him, saying, I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses trembled and durst not behold. Then said the Lord to him, put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. I have seen the affliction of my people which is in Egypt, and have heard their groaning, and am come down to deliver them, and now come, I will send thee into Egypt. This Moses whom they refused, saying, who made thee a ruler and a judge, the same did God send to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel which appeared to him in the bush. And he brought them out after he had showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses which said to the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren, like unto me, him shall ye hear. Stephen is now getting kind of to the crux, the focal point of what he's been trying to get the Sanhedrin to understand. Here's our history. We know how God has used various people in the past. And now we come to this passage where he is going to refer back to the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses tells them in the second giving of the law, there's going to be a prophet come that's going to be like me. Hear him. It's one of those prophetic passages of their coming Messiah. This is that prophet that Moses is referring to. He's going to be raised up out of your brethren. He's going to be like me. Him shall you hear. A great deliverer. The Israelites know Moses as that great deliverer. He brought them out of the land of Egypt, brought them to the threshold of the promised land. He delivered them. God used him mightily. There's going to be another deliverer. He's not going to deliver you from physical bondage. That one like Moses is going to deliver you from spiritual bondage. He's going to be your redeemer. And so he notes that as we come to this passage and tells them of their coming Messiah. We continue, but they reject. It says, to whom, verse 39, to whom our fathers would not obey, but thrust him from them, and in their hearts turned back again to Egypt. I skipped over 38. I thought something was out. Verse 38, this is he that was in the church in the wilderness, which the angel which spake to him in the Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, who received the lively oracles to give unto us, to our fathers, to whom our fathers would not obey, but thrust him from them, and in their hearts turned back again into Egypt. So he's noting that this prophet, this redeemer, and he's kind of noting kind of a, not really a Christophany, but noting who followed the Israelites in the wilderness. Who was with them? Who led them? God. Led them how? A pillar of fire and smoke, depending on the time of day. It's a cloudy pillar during the day, and it's a pillar of fire at night. He's alluding to that this is Christ. It's God. Elsewhere we know that Christ will follow them in the wilderness. Christ was the rock. But he notes here that this is he that was in the church in the wilderness, the assembly. Other translations may not have church there. It's our word ecclesia, which we translate as church. Was Israel the church in the wilderness? Not in the sense as we use the word church. Were they an assembly in the wilderness? Were they a called out assembly in the wilderness? Yes. God called them. God called them out. Starting with Abraham, their great, 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 great grandfather, and following that line. So they are, in the technical sense of the word, the literal sense, they are a called out assembly. That's why Luke uses that word, ecclesia, there. Now, for the King James, why they put church there doesn't make much sense to me, apart from any Reformed theology that may be trying to have put itself in there by our King James translators. But they are a called out assembly. The word's right. It's just not the church. But he uses that word, puts it there. And God speaks to them. We know, again, the story. How are the Israelites in the 40 years of wilderness wandering? Do they love the Lord? Do they have a happy, enjoyable time? No, they don't. We know that they're wandering for 40 years because of their rebellion. When they come to the threshold of entering the promised land, after 2 years, what is their reaction? Nope, can't do this. These 12 spies have come back. 10 have said, can't do it. 2 have said, yes. We're going to go with the majority and say, no, we can't do this. We can't go in there. And God says, fine. And for every day that they were in there, you guys are going to wander around in this wilderness till you that are 20 years old and older are going to die off. And I'll take the next generation into the land. At times, what did they want to do? Moses, you're not feeding us. Moses, you don't have water. Let's create us a captain and do what? Let's go back to Egypt. Man, we had leeks and garlics and stuff there. They are a rebellious bunch. They rejected Moses. We see that over and over again. They didn't want him. I don't see how Moses lived for 40 years with these people leading them. But he did. He's got a lot more patience, long-suffering, a lot more of everything that I know I don't have. But he does. He puts up with them. And he does lead them. But God notes that. You know, they wanted to turn around, head back. They didn't, thankfully. But we continue on, verse 40, saying unto Aaron, make us gods to go before us, for as for this Moses, which brought us out of the land of Egypt, we want not what has become of him, which is going back to when he's receiving those oracles. He's on Mount Sinai getting the Ten Commandments. He's gone for 40 days. The Israelites are down there twiddling their thumbs. We can't go up on this mountain. What are we supposed to do? You're supposed to wait. Okay, what's happening? Aaron, make us our God. Make us Jehovah. Says, fine, give me your gold. And he makes a calf, verse 41. I love the story back then. Aaron tells Moses, yeah, they gave me their gold and I cast it into the fire and this is what came out. A golden calf. Whoa. Yeah. Who says God doesn't have a sense of humor? He's got these passages in there for us. Verse 41, and they made a calf in those days and offered sacrifice unto the idol and rejoiced in the works of their own hands. Then God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven. As it is written in the book of the prophets, O ye house of Israel, ye have offered to me slain beasts and sacrifices by the space of 40 years in the wilderness. Yea, ye took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of your god Rephan, figures which ye made to worship them, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. So he quickly kind of moves on to point them towards them going into captivity at some point. As again, he notes in the book of Deuteronomy, he gives the blessings and curses, notes to the Israelites, you worship me, you obey me, and you have what? Blessings. You turn your back on me, and you have what? My curse is on you. You keep at this, and I will take you out of this land. I will remove you bodily. They have that warning, if you will, all the way back in Moses' lifetime. Do they go into captivity? Yes, they do. 700 years later, the northern 10 tribes go into captivity. About 160-ish years later, the rest of them go into captivity. Do we have a long-suffering God? A patient God with us in our troubles? In our trying to live for Him or not live for Him? Yes, we do. And we see it exemplified in the Old Testament with the Israelites. And we see that brought back up here that they're going to rebel against God. And God's going to fulfill what He promised them He would do. And He sends them into captivity in Babylon. And using Babylon as that last one, because that's the last captivity, the last of the Israelites being taken from the land. Verse 44, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness. We move on then to the building of the tabernacle. Our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as He had appointed, speaking unto Moses, that he should make it according to the fashion that he had seen, which also our fathers that came after brought with Jesus, that is Joshua. The Greek Jesus is the same as the Hebrew Joshua. That's the name change as you go from one language to the next. And so that's why our translators did Jesus, not Joshua, but is referring to Joshua, and brought them into the possession of the Gentiles, whom God drave out before the face of our fathers unto the days of David, who found favor before God and desired to find a tabernacle for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him an house, howbeit the Most High dwelleth not in temples made with hands, as saith the prophet. Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. What house will ye build me, saith the Lord, or what is the place of my rest? Hath not my hand made all these things? Ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, ye do always resist the Holy Ghost, as your fathers did, so do ye. Which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted, and have slain them which showed before the coming of the Just One, of whom ye have now been the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the disposition of angels and have not kept it? He brings it home and brings them back to the Lord Jesus, reminding them, you're the ones that killed our Messiah. He goes through the construction, as we noted, of the temple. David wanted to, he didn't. Solomon builds it. But God dwells not in buildings made with hands, because He made all of this. He then quotes from Isaiah chapter 66, talking about heaven being His throne and the earth being His footstool. And so He's given them the history. And we've made it through that. We've made it through the first part without going back through the B and C parts. And we'll pick up on that next Sunday night and look at seeing those blessings. And we'll move through these obviously quicker because we've already made our way through his discourse, because that ends it as he brings them up to Christ. Our history, as he tells them, our history as Hebrews, as Jews, as God's chosen people, points us to our Messiah. And you, Sanhedrin, crucified him. Does that necessarily sound like the good way to bring up your defense against people that are against you? No, it doesn't. But yet, is it the truth that needs to be told? Yes. They still need the message. And Stephen takes that message to them, reminding them of their history and how God, all through that time, was with them. Even in their rebellion, God was still with them. Don't follow the rebellion. Follow God. And so we'll pick up on the blessings and the oppositions, again, that we've already kind of touched on along the way, and come back through this real quick and note some of these things next week. And then finish off the chapter as we see the rest of what is laid out here. Stephen doesn't fare. We know the story. But notice that we'll see the reaction that these men have, a very satanic reaction. And sad to see. But thankfully we have an open time that we can tell of Christ in our day. May it not scare us from speaking of Christ. But let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for the time that we've had in your word as we've looked at Stephen's discourse, his sermon, if you will, to the Sanhedrin, reminding them of their history, bringing up these points for a very particular reason, because their history points to their Redeemer. He's promised all the way back in the book of Genesis. And Father, he had come. And these men knew that. They saw him. They saw his ministry. And they rejected him. And Father, whether they reject or not, the message still needs to be given to them. We praise the Lord that Stephen was willing to do so, a deacon in the church in Jerusalem. And yet he stood faithfully for you. And we thank you for this testimony. Pray that you give us boldness in the day that we need it to speak out for Christ. We thank you that we do not live in a day when there is such open antagonism, such hatred. But Father, that seems to be growing in our day. So as we wait for your coming, may we faithfully give thy word where there is relative peace, where there is a relative openness to share the gospel. The day is coming when your hand of judgment will come upon this world. But Father, we live in a time where that's not taking place. And so may we be faithful in sharing your word, in living your word, in being the testimony that you would have us to be in our day, as Stephen was in his. Dismiss us in thy care. May we go forth in thy strength and power and might. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.